Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 4, Side 1. The fifth ship seemed to have closed in on the others. Johnny shook his head at himself. This was not the time to be doing crazy, reckless things. He had almost done exactly what he had warned Stormy not to do, go visiting. The old relic he was flying had become heated from air friction. It was built to take it, but he had come up for a cool breath of air, and now the flight deck was hot. If he'd really wanted to go up there, he would have taken just an ordinary battle plane, making sure its gaskets were tight around the doors, and making sure its guns were loaded and working. Sir Robert would not have been proud of him. Another blip on his view screens, down low at about 100,000 feet of altitude. Coming on a route from Scotland? America over the pole? Warm cabin or no cabin, he streaked down to intercept and identify. He flipped on his local command channel, and just as he did so, a voice from the nearby plane came through.
"Don't shoot. I'll marry your daughter."
It was Dunnell Dean. Johnny laughed. It was the first time he had laughed since returning from America. He spun the old relic around and flashed after Dunnell Dean as the Scot roared down toward the mine site. 4. The small gray man in his small gray cabin was sighing patiently. Well, not too patiently. His indigestion had not improved at all, and now this. Things were distressing enough without the military people getting into fights among themselves. But it was a military matter, not political, not economic, and not strategic. So he was perforce out of it, a mere observer. He now had 4 faces on his separate view screens, and if it kept on going this way, he'd have to ask his communications officer to break more screens out of stores and put them in on a rack. It made one's office so cluttered. The face of the Tallnep half-captain was quite angry-looking, and he kept adjusting his glasses in an agitated way.
"But I don't care if you were surprised to see me here. I have no advices at all that our nations are at war."
The Hovind's face was the light violet Hovind's got when they were very provoked. The square helmet was crushed down on his oval head, bending his ear antennae. His untoothed but blade-gummed mouth was distorted in the lifted attitude of biting.
"How would you know who was at war and who wasn't at war? You cannot be less than 5 months out from any base."
The Hockner super-lieutenant who commanded the star-shaped craft looked a little supercilious with his monocle and excessive amount of gold braid. The long, noseless face portrayed what passed for disdain among his people in the Duraleb system. The bull bod was just plain plug ugly, as they always were, bigger than cyclos, but sort of shapeless. One wondered how they ever handled anything at all. Their hands were always clenched into fists. The high sweater neck almost met the bill of his exaggerated cap. The bulbods considered insignia beneath their dignity, but the small gray man knew he was gang leader Poundon, commanding the cylinder-shaped spacecraft. He certainly had a low opinion of all the rest as effete degenerates.
"All right," snapped the Tallnep. "Are our races at war, or aren't they?"
The Hovind said.
"I don't have any information that they are or aren't, but that doesn't mean that they aren't. It would not be the first time a Hovind ship came peacefully onto station, only to be raked by a sneaking Tallnep."
"Your Excellency,"
snapped the Tallnep, suddenly including the small gray man,
"do you have any information that the Tallneps and Hovinds are at war?"
It was a military matter, but this could fringe on the political. "The courier ship that met me here did not mention it," he said tiredly. Maybe one of the crew had some different brand of indigestion tablets. No, he didn't think they would. Mellow jest was all that was sold these days. He wished they'd stop wrangling.
"You see," hissed the Tallnep half-captain, "no war exists. yet you come in here denting my plates in an unprovoked assault.
Did I really dent your plates?
Said the Hoven, abruptly interested.
Here, said the Hockner super-lieutenant. Here now. You are both completely off the subject of the strange interceptor. If you two fellows want to draw off somewhere and batter away at each other, that's your business, isn't it? But who and what was that interceptor?
The Balbod snorted.
Couldn't be anything but Cyclo.
I know, old fellow, said the Hockner, adjusting his monocle. But I've looked it up, and it isn't listed under Cyclo Military Craft. He held a recognition book to the screen. Known types of Cyclo Warcraft. It was, of course, in Cyclo. All of them spoke Cyclo, and the whole of their cross-communication was in Cyclo, since they didn't speak each other's native tongues.
It isn't listed here.
The Hoven was glad to drop the subject of his attack on the Tallnep, no matter how surprised he'd been to find a Tallnep ship here.
I've never seen one like it.
The Balbod was more practical.
Why did it veer away the moment you stopped shooting?
They pondered that for a while. Then the Hockner adjusted his monocle and said,
I rather think I have it. He supposed that our attention would be distracted, and that this, he snorted, battle would knock out some of us, and he'd be able to mop up the damaged remainder.
They talked about this for a while. The small gray man listened politely to their military theories. It was none of his concern. They finally came to the conclusion that that was what it was all about. The interceptor had come up, ready to take advantage of the battle and destroy the remainder left over when they were in a damaged condition.
I think they must be very clever, said the Hockner. Probably they have other interceptors here, and they're ready and waiting. I could have eaten that one with one bite, said the Hoven. I could have knocked it out with one punch, said the Balbod. If they were strong, they would have come up here and smashed us up some days ago. I don't think they're Cyclos, and I never before heard of any race that had that torch insignia. So I say they are very weak. I don't know why we just don't go down and wipe them out as a combined force.
A combined force was a brand new idea. The three others had always considered Balbods rather stupid, if strong, and they looked at him on their view screens with a dawning respect.
We've never, any of us, said the Hockner, made any real dent in the Cyclos. But it does seem to me that they are not really Cyclos. Strange ship, strange insignia. So possibly it would just be an afternoon's work to go down as a combined force.
Knock them out and divide the loot, finished the Tallnep.
This was verging on the political. So the small gray man said,
And what if they are the one?
This was what they were here to determine. They chewed it over. They finally came to a unanimous conclusion. They would operate as a combined force. Any newcomer would be invited. They would wait for the return of the courier ship the small gray man had sent out, even though it might not return for months. If it brought news that the one had been found elsewhere, this combined force would go down, knock the planet out, and divide the loot among them to recompense them for their time. They didn't lay out any system for dividing the loot, for each had his own ideas of what would happen when that moment came. The plan was agreed to.
What if something happens in the meanwhile to prove it is the one?
The small gray man asked.
Violence, violence. All these military people ever thought about was violence and death.
Well, they decided, that was sort of political, and they would play it by ear. But also, if it were the one, probably it ought to be knocked out, so the same plan applied. It was the first time the small gray man had ever seen independent commanders of traditionally hostile ships reach a firm agreement on something. But these were very unusual times. When they clicked off their view screens, the small gray man reached for another pill of Mellowjest to help his indigestion, and then put it back in the bottle. He thought he'd go down and visit that old woman again. Maybe she had an antidote for Yarb tea. 5. Their heads were bent together in the dull green reflection of the viewers. They were in a small, converted, lead-lined storage room in the lowest level of the African mine site. Johnny was getting his first look at the fruits of earlier work. There were 10 days' worth of discs, and it was a considerable pile. Dunnell Dean had explained that he couldn't come earlier. There were lots of pilots graduating and needing their final checkout flights, and it would have been suspicious to leave America at a busy peak. He had also brought 14 new pilots to Africa, and Johnny and Stormalong could nurse them through their advanced combat here. They were good lads, Swedes and Germans. Care was going full blast training machine operators. Every tribe seemed to want a blade scraper and flatbeds for buses. Brown Limper was selling the tribe's equipment even from their own nearby mine sites, and they had to have operators. Ore carriers were busy lugging machinery over the globe, and they had to have pilots. Angus had come back with Dunnell Dean, for he was finding it too hard not to shoot Lars Thorensen on sight. There was also the matter of Page One. Johnny skimmed through the beginnings of Turl's reoccupancy. It was enough to know that that crucial hour after he had left had really been pay dirt. They'd planted 32 false bugs, and even feeders and recorders, and there was Turl, big as life, dumping them on his desk, convinced. When he saw that Turl was apparently using a mine radio to detect feeder channels to the recorders, he had a moment's qualm, but then he realized their main feeder was a ground wave. A false bottom to the cabinets. He hadn't suspected that, for they simply looked armored. And this huge, thick book he was bringing out, about 3 feet wide and 2 feet high and 7 inches thick, and on the thinnest paper he had ever seen. Thousands of pages. Each page was divided into about 40 vertical columns. Over at the left, the widest column gave the name of a system, and below it, the names of planets in that system. From left to right in the columns followed every movement of the system, such as its speed of travel and direction, precession, torque, and the weight and quality of the sun, or suns if double or treble. In the columns beside every planet of that system were noted that planet's own weight, rotation period, atmosphere, surface temperatures, races, city coordinates, relative mineral estimate by symbols, and value in galactic credits, and the location of its mine sites, if any. All speeds and directions of travel were based on the zero center of that universe and three-dimensional compass coordinates using the inevitable cyclonumeral 11 and parts of 11 and powers of 11. Turl had sat there day after day, turning pages of it, one by one, running a claw down one particular column. He had gone through the whole book. They had every page.
"Accept page one," said Dunnell Dean. "I don't understand several of these symbols, because they are so abbreviated. Look at how tiny these figures are. We reviewed it and found we didn't have page one. We figured that would be the symbol key code, and Turl knew it all so well that he never referred to it. But look at that last disc there."
Johnny was a bit dazzled. He had had no idea there were that many populated systems, much less planets. Thousands and thousands and thousands. It would take somebody a month or two just to count them. 16 universes. And these were only the ones the Cyclos had an interest in. This accumulated knowledge must have taken several millennia to compile. He looked very closely at the writing. He could swear it was Jinko. He came out of it a bit. "I don't understand some of these symbols," he said.
"That's what I'm trying to tell you. That was part of the delay. I didn't want to put you in the frying pan waiting for the key to the symbols, so we did the waiting. Look at the last disc."
Johnny did so. Turl had thrown the whole book down, and the ventilator had blown up the cover by accident, and there was page one, all the symbols listed and what they meant. "We've got all the positions and firing coordinates of 16 universes," said Johnny. Then he sobered. What was he looking for? Turl had thrown the book down in disgust. That was plain. Johnny played the disc a little more. The sound on it, which was not of much use, was very colorful cyclo-cursing. For those whole 2 days, a blank piece of paper had been lying there with not a mark on it. Now Turl almost ruined his pen as he wrote a figure on it. Johnny went back to an earlier disc and looked more critically at what column Turl's claw was moving down. By the symbol at the top of it, the column was Transshipment Firing Times 2/at Cyclo. Johnny understood it. Turl was trying to find an open period at Cyclo so that nothing he shipped would collide with something some other planet was shipping. Johnny recalled from his machine training days that the Cyclos never changed these tables for decades on end. Looking at the number of planets sending and receiving, the Cyclo platform must run constantly, day and night. He also had gotten the impression that one planet couldn't have two platforms operating, for it made interference. The nearest second platform for transshipment had to be about 50,000 miles away, and since the diameter of Cyclo was only about 25,000 miles, they only had one platform. So, if Turl didn't want to collide with somebody else's ore arriving, or smelted metal going out to some buyers, or maybe military hardware, he had to be careful to find an open period. If one fired ore or machinery, one could be quick about it, but live personnel required a longer time period, or it shook them up. Turl was taking no chances with his own neck. The figure he so disgustedly wrote, almost breaking his pen, was Day 92. He had been forced to choose a time more than 5 months from now. It was quite evident from the amount of Kerbango he then consumed that the thought of spending all that additional time on this accursed planet, as the Sonic recorded him saying, was upsetting. He had had to choose Earth's next scheduled semi-annual, and finally, by the next day, he had reconciled himself to it. Expecting the new disks would show the beginning calculations and circuits of a transshipment console, Johnny was amazed not to find it. Turl had gone to another cabinet and opened up its back. Using both paws, he removed a package. It appeared to be a bit heavy. He opened up the wrappings and then got a big pair of tongs, big enough to lift a huge boulder. He screwed the gap down to about 1/4 inch and reached into the package. The picture didn't show what he was lifting out at first. Then he dropped it, and it hit the floor. Turl's curse was very sharp. He got down with the tongs and lifted a gray something about the size of a pea. For an instant, the spot on the floor showed. Johnny still framed it. The metal floor was dented deeply. Turl managed to pick up the small object again with the tongs, a hard job because it had sunk in the floor. He lifted it back up to lay on the side of the table. Johnny did a very quick calculation. He knew how strong Turl was within rough limits. The amount of effort, when you subtracted those big tongs, made that little pea-sized piece of metal weigh about 75 pounds at a wild guess. Johnny got busy. He called Angus and had him set up the mineral analyzer that should transfer traces from the disk and enlarge them. He went and got the trace code books. For the next 3 hours, they tried to find that trace. It wasn't there. The Cyclos didn't list it, or any composite trace of it, in any of their code books. They were dealing with a metal the Cyclos had but didn't list. Johnny tried to estimate by weight and volume and periodic tables what its atomic number was. The Earth tables were of no value at all. This thing would be way off the bottom of them. He looked over the Cyclo periodic tables, so different from the old Earth ones. There were a lot of elements that would have atomic numbers as high as this one, maybe even higher. But if they didn't have its name, Johnny suddenly realized it probably wasn't on the cyclo table either, if it wasn't in their analysis books.
I wish I were some good at this, said Johnny.
But, laddie, said Donald Dean, I think you're a plain wizard. I fell in the mine shaft about 2 hours ago and haven't been heard of since.
Johnny said, these are atomic numbers. An atom is supposedly composed of a core with energy particles in it, some of them positively charged, some of them not charged at all. The number of positively charged particles is what they call the atomic number, and these particles, together with the uncharged particles, make up the atomic weight. Also, around the core are negatively charged particles that circle the core in what they call rings or shells. But they're not. They are more like envelopes. Anyway, the core and the negatively charged particles around it gives one the different elements. That's about all there is to a periodic table, to oversimplify it. But ancient man here on Earth constructed his tables on oxygen and carbon, I think because those were important to him. He is a carbon-oxygen engine. But a cyclo has a different metabolism and burns different elements for energy, so the cyclo table is different. Also, cyclos had a lot more universes to work in, and they had metals and gases Earth's old scientists never heard of. The ancients here on Earth also omitted distances of spacing between the core and the ring, and between ring and ring, as a variable. So they didn't realize that one core and one ring at one spacing could be quite something else when the spacing changed. Got it?
Laddie, said Donald Dean, that thump you just heard was me hitting the bottom of the shaft.
Don't be lonely down there, said Johnny. I hit it every time I get tangled up in this. But the point is, what is he up to? This is not a transshipment rig component. They looked at other disks. Turl considered metal like a man would consider paper, easily worked with. He had bullied Lars into getting him a sheet of a beryllium alloy, and it almost hurt their ears when Lars couldn't find it anywhere in the compound, and Turl told him the blank stuff was what they used for panel metal in vehicles, and to go down to the blank garages and get into that blank zits repair supplies and get him a blank sheet of the stuff. Lars trotted back shortly, his panting clear on the disc sonic, bringing a sheet of beryllium alloy that rumbled as it waved about. Turl kicked him out and locked the door. They did a quick analysis of the metal, and even Donald Dean had no trouble with the traces. It was beryllium, copper, and nickel, sort of rough, for it had not been polished. On the disc, Turl took some shears and cut expertly. Then he folded some edges. He annealed the edges shut by molecular bind. Then he had a top which fit very well. He put a little knob on the top for lifting it. Then he cut a hole in the bottom of the box and made a screw-in access plate. He had begun to laugh, so it was easy to divine that this was something quite nasty. It was a pretty box when he finished. He polished it up and buffed it, and it looked like jewelry, a gold color. Pretty. It was hexagonal, each one of the 6 sides and corners geometrically precise. Quite a work of art. The top came off easily. The bottom hole access plate was left unscrewed. It was about 1 foot across and about 5 inches high. The next day, he went to work on the inside. He made some very precisely hinged rods, quite intricate. He fitted them into the box and tested them. There was a hinged rod in each of the 6 corners, and it was fastened to the lid. When you raised the lid, these rods pushed sockets, empty as yet, to the center of the box. He tested it several times and laughed louder as he gazed up into it from the access hole in the bottom. The cover came off very smoothly. Each of the 6 rods pushed an empty socket to the center. Then he chased Lars all around, finding different common substances, and eventually he had 3 different metals and 3 different non-metals in a pile. They were just ordinary elements, the analyzer said. Iron, silicon, sodium, magnesium, sulfur, and phosphorus. Why? To what end? Johnny tore through some books. Sodium, magnesium, sulfur, and phosphorus had one thing in common. They were of use, one way or another, in explosives. Knowing Turl, that was the first thing Johnny looked up. But this combination he didn't think would explode, because there they lay, right on the table in an earlier frame, right together, and they didn't explode. Iron and silicon? It seemed that they were very common indeed in the composition of the Earth's crust and core. He looked at a later frame, quite apprehensive. What if Turl made something and then hid it outside and they couldn't find it? What was this devil up to? Ah, Turl might have jumbled up the six elements, but the strange pea-sized mineral had vanished. Johnny backtracked on the disk. Turl had taken the heavy bit of strange metal and measured it, and then had wrapped it all up and put it back in the false cabinet. The place where it had lain now had a dent. He made a braced basket to hold the pea in the center. But he didn't put it in, for it was now back in the cabinet. Then he put the six common elements, each one, in the slots on the rods. When one opened the lid, the rods pushed them all into the center. They would go into contact with each other and with the pea. Johnny knew something about radiation and elements after their early battle. He knew that all you had to do was stimulate the atoms to get a chain reaction going. But Turl was not working with uranium radiation. He couldn't. Not with the overstimulation radiation gave to breathe gas. So that pea thing must be some higher order of stimulation. Knowing Turl, it would be deadly. He was sure that when that heavy, heavy, pea-sized piece of metal was in the center, and somebody opened the lid and all those metals pushed together and against it, something ghastly was going to happen. Turl locked the pretty box away, cleaned things up, and opened a mathematics text entitled Force Equations, which had nothing to do with teleportation. What was he up to now? And that was as far as the disks went. Their own clock had moved up to noon, as they had gone non-stop, no sleep, no food.
"Now I know who made Satan," said Donald Dean. "His name was Turtle."
6. Since Turl seemed to be working on other things than teleportation, which was the key to this entire dilemma, Johnny, for the time being, turned his attention to other things. He had not entirely lost hope of unraveling the cyclotechnology through the restoration and possible cooperation of the remaining cyclos. If he could get the two pieces of metal out of the head of a trained cyclo engineer, there was a possibility that some of these mysteries would be solved, and solved, they would leave them in better control of the planet's future. Dr. McKendrick had returned. One or two of the African base people had come down with a touch of what McKendrick said was malaria carried by mosquitoes. McKendrick had procured cinchona bark from South America and had made them mop up standing pools of water in the base and put nets over the air intake vents, and all that seemed to be under control. McKendrick's three remaining cyclo patients, two of whom were rated engineers, were not, however, so easily handled as the malaria. They were not getting well. They remained barely alive. The 33 live cyclos from the American compound arrived in Africa without incident and were put in a prepared dorm section. They had been duly reported as lost at sea in a plane crash. But the doctor did not have much hope for it. "I have tried every way I can think of," he told Johnny one evening in his underground African surgery, "and one can't get through the intricate skull structure to the items without severely damaging it. Every cyclo cadaver I have worked with so far plainly shows that critical skull bone joints would be very damaged and vital brain nerves would be severed. Those things were put into the soft skull of a newborn pup, and even within a few months,
the skull would have been hardened to a point where they could not be removed. I will go on working with cyclocadavers, but I cannot hold out any real hope."
Johnny wandered off from the conference, trying to think of some solution to that problem. It seemed these days he had a lot more problems than he had solutions. He felt that if he didn't come up with some solutions fairly soon, the human race might well be a write-off. He heard his name called. He was passing by one of the doors that housed the new cyclo arrivals, and he stopped and went over. There was a small viewport and an intercom inset into the door panel. It was Chirk. He had never had anything against Chirk, a rattlebrain and dedicated to wrong conclusions though she might be. The times when he had seen her, they had not fought.
"Johnny," said Chirk, "I just want to thank you for saving us."
Johnny realized somebody had been talking to the cyclos, maybe Dunnell Dean.
"When I think of what that awful Tyrrell planned to do, murder us all, you know, oh, my fur crackles. I always thought you were kind of cute, Johnny. You know that? So I know you saved our lives."
Johnny said, "You're welcome. Can I do anything for you?" She looked pretty forlorn, really. No clothes, but a wraparound. Fur all matted.
"No," said Chirk. "Just thank you."
Johnny walked off and was halfway down the passage before the weirdness of it struck him. A cyclo being thankful? Expressing appreciation? Not wanting something? Impossible. He had never had much to do with female cyclos. They were not numerous in the company. But a grateful cyclo? Never. He acted fast. 10 minutes later, they had a mineral analyzer rigged and Chirk's head in it. 20 minutes of investigation, and they had an answer. Chirk did not have any bronze object in her head. She did have a silver capsule, but it was of different shape and size. There were 12 females from the American compound, and after a great deal of hustle and bustle and assembly line treatment, they had established that none of the females had a bronze object in their brains, but they did have silver ones of the same pattern as Chirk's. 2 pilots took off for the morgue in the clouds, accompanied by a fur-wrapped McKendrick, and they soon established, working in the icy blast of a keen wind, that they had 3 females in that lot. That night, McKendrick held out the different capsule to Johnny and Angus. He had removed it from the female corpse that had been brought back. Careful examination showed it to have a less complex internal filament, but that was all they could tell.
"I don't think that could be cut out either," said Dr. McKendrick. "The structure of the female skull is even more complicated than the male's. All I can contribute is that it probably puts out a different message when activated."
That seemed to be pretty well that. However, the bronze cruelty factor was missing in a female, so the following morning Johnny had another talk with Chirk.
"How would you like a job?" said Johnny. "Well, that would be wonderful. It just showed he was cute. Because she couldn't go back to Cyclo now. Tyrrell had ruined her company record, and they would never re-employ her with the black marks of disobedience all over the file. And if he promised not to send her back to Cyclo and paid her usual wage of 200 galactic credits a month, a job would be a very good thing, for she was going mad from inactivity and no cosmetics."
For a long time now, they had been taking galactic credits out of company payroll offices, out of the wallets of dead cyclos, out of canteen cash drawers, and they had a couple of million credits kicking around. So it was feasible. They struck a bargain. Loosed with a breathe mask and a sentry, Chirk promptly found a few yards of cloth and supply, was escorted down to the lake, and, oblivious of crocodiles, took a bath. She then demanded access to the minerals sample room of the compound. She got some white gypsum, put it in a mortar, and finally pulverized it, and put it in a sample bag. She threw some copper in a retort, added some acid, boiled it all away, washed the residue, and mixed it with some clear motor grease. She put it in a can. She got some tractor paint out of the storeroom, deepened its color to a brilliant purple by boiling it, and added simple stain dye, and then poured in a pungent thinner. She put the last in a bottle. Then she went to the tailor shop and slashed and annealed dress uniform cloth. She took some seat covering and cut it and annealed it into a pair of flare-topped boots and demanded to be taken back to her room. Shortly, there emerged the most stylish female a Cyclo Street had ever seen. Although the breathe mask hid the face makeup, one supposed that it was there for morale. And if you looked closely through the leaded faceplate, you could see that she had brilliant green lip bones, a glaring white nose bone, and white and green circles around her eye bones. Her claws were a glaring shade of purple. The white dress uniform cloth was topped with a flaring gold collar and bound about by a gold-colored belt, and her boots were gold with purple sole lines. Chirk then demanded access to another room where the other females were kept, and thereafter the current base commander was besieged with demands for more contracts at 200 galactic credits a month and clothes. Although Johnny had not really expected much help from that quarter, he got it unexpectedly. Shortly, he would get trouble, but to begin with, it was revelatory. Chirk made a trip out to find some mud. In that area, there was lots of mud, but she was looking for a certain kind of mud. She chattered away at Angus as they tramped about. She was carrying a 200-pound scope under her arm like it was a handbag. Johnny saw them walking around the edge of a swamp, Angus dwarfed by the 800-pound female, two sentries following, mostly in case of wild beasts. Johnny went over to them. She was looking for mud. She would stick in a paddle and put a dab on the scope plate and shake her head and walk on. She didn't seem to be getting anywhere. Johnny noticed something odd in animal behavior. When he went out, the game ignored him. But Chirk? You couldn't see game as far as you could look. Not an elephant, not a lion, no deer, nothing. He reasoned it must be the smell of a Cyclo. Where once animals fled at the smell of a man, over the centuries they had transferred their survival instincts. They wouldn't let a Cyclo within miles of them. Still, this area hadn't been hunted out, and neither had any other area.
"Oh, Cyclo men don't mass hunt," said Chirk, busy with her paddle and scope. "The silly things find just one animal and follow it, and then they sit around in a circle and take 3 days to kill it little by little. So they don't often get 3 days off. Not in this company. Silly things, males."
Johnny did not enlighten her as to what made them silly. After a while, she found her mud. She filled a mine bucket with it and easily carried the 200-pound scope and the 400 pounds of mud back to the compound. She put the mud in glass bottles and added some green liquid goo food, and then rinsed the mud out. She handed the bottles to McKendrick, who gazed at them in mystery.
Chirk said, "Put that in the wounds, you foolish creature. How can you expect them to heal up if you don't use a countervirus? Any child knows that."
McKendrick got it. His treatments were all aimed at bacterial control on beings who were basically virus-structured. Within the next 3 days, all his Cyclo patients began to get well. Their festering wounds closed, and it appeared they were going to have 3 completely cured ones soon. Chirk got to work on the library. It shocked her that the volumes were so strewn about, and for 2 days she did nothing but collect Cyclo books into huge piles. The other females helped, and also began to clean up large areas of old Cyclo berthings. Johnny was working one day in the old Cyclo operations room when Chirk suddenly presented herself.
"Your library," she said, "is in disgraceful condition. According to company regulations, certain book lists must be in every mine site, and you can see by this form that the manager here has been negligent and should be given a black mark on his record. But I am working for you now, so I must call to your attention Form 2,345,980A. If you place this order with Cyclo, they will send them out on the next shipment. It is a very serious matter, an incomplete library.
Chirk might not be in present time about the company, but she certainly had filled out the form. Johnny hadn't even known the form existed, and he found himself staring at one item checked as missing. War vessel recognition tables of hostile races, and another, individual troop combat capabilities catalogued by alien races. Chirk went back to work putting books in order on shelves, but within minutes Johnny had 30 people, including two pilots, ransacking the place. The visitors upstairs could be identified, and some means of defense might exist. Sir Robert had returned from Scotland that morning, and it was he who guessed it.
"Johnny, that group here didn't know who was attacking. Anyone in command here would have been tearing through those books. Have you looked on the corpses?"
That's where they were, in a shoulder bag on the body of a former mine manager up in the snow. Not more than 3 hours later, comparing his own and Stormalong's pictures and the texts, he knew he was dealing with Tallneps, Hockners, Balbods, and Hovens. And he knew what they looked like and what their capabilities were. All dangerously nasty. There was no listing for the globe-shaped ship with the ring around it, or any race of small gray men. But the following day his luck ran out with Chirk. She had been doing very well, but he made a mistake. She was sitting, all 800 pounds of her, at a desk in the library making some lists. Johnny was looking at a sheet of figures he had drawn up. The sheet concerned distances from Earth to various hostile bases nearest to it, and the speeds of the types of alien ships. They had different types of drives. For the most part, they ran on energy accumulated from suns, but they handled it differently. He was trying to calculate how many months those ships were from their relative bases. Turl's lists of inhabited planets had now been copied off in sheet form, and it was evident they didn't include all systems or suns, but only those in which Cyclo had an interest. Johnny had been amazed to find in other texts that there were 400 billion suns in this galaxy alone, and that this universe contained more than 100 billion galaxies. And he had 16 universes to look at. The possible bases of hostile peoples were easier to mentally encompass. From Earth to this galaxy's center was about 30,000 light-years, and one light-year was about 6 trillion miles. All these enemy ships exceeded the speed of light one way or another, but this still made it necessary to compute by how much they exceeded against what base where. It was an awful lot of cycloarithmetic. He was not too patient doing it by hand. Thoughtlessly, he said to Chirk, "Could you help me add these figures up?" She looked at him, totally blank, for about a minute. Then she said,
"I don't know how."
Johnny smiled. "It's just arithmetic. Here, I'll show you." Chirk's eyes glazed. She fell forward across the desk. There was no response from her. She was totally unconscious. They had to get a forklift in and take her to her room and put her to bed. 3 days later, McKendrick told Johnny,
"She's just lying there in a coma. Maybe in time she'll come out of it. She seems to have had a heavy shock."
Although he felt bad about it, Johnny had an idea now of what the silver capsule in the females was. They were not to be taught any cyclomathematics, ever. The key to the whole cyclo-empire must be mathematics, and aside from their arithmetic, he couldn't make head or tail of their equations. It seemed to be a dead end. 7. They had just completed the installation of a radio telescope when the courier came in. Angus, his face red, first from sun at lake level, and then from wind and snow, up at the summit of nearby Mount Elgon, was very proud of himself. The German and Swedish pilots, with something to do besides train under the relentless storm along, had helped find and install the huge reflector bowls and relays from the peaks and down to the mine site. Now that they had the frequencies, Angus was saying, they would soon be hearing everything those monkeys up there were saying to each other. He'd even have them on the screens. Johnny's ear caught the far-off approach of the plane above the overcast. He thanked Angus and the pilots and said they had done very well, and yes, now maybe they would know more about the intentions of their visitors.
Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 4, Side 2. Johnny's ear caught the far-off approach of the plane above the overcast. He thanked Angus and the pilots and said they had done very well. And yes, now maybe they would know more about the intentions of their visitors. Glenn Cannon had taken over the ferrying of the vital disks from America. A copy was now going to Dr. McDermott to bury in a deep underground vault, and the originals were coming through to Johnny in Africa. Glenn Cannon had lots of news. Patty had been extremely ill for weeks, but Chrissy was nursing her and there was hope. And Chrissy sent her love and said she'd found a lovely old house right near Castle Rock, and some of the chief's wives were helping her find real furniture in old ruins. And she sent her love, and when was he coming back? Castle Rock was now so surrounded with anti-aircraft blast cannon, it made one fair nervous to fly near it. Dunnell Dean? Oh, he was flying the pants off new recruits, but there weren't as many coming in now. Mostly machine operators were getting trained. Care was fine and sent him some brand new air masks he'd made that fit better, and said not to turn him in for stealing company materials. Ha ha. And here were some personal letters for Sir Robert. And here was the latest set of you-know-whats. Johnny went deep underground and got the disks rolling. They had the place well set up now. Watching the female cyclos while not letting them handle anything vital, they had learned the use of some of the office machinery they had earlier ignored, and they could copy disks and make blow-ups of sections with a fine-line accuracy they had not thought possible. They had cabinets for files, and all in all, they could make the disks talk much better. Turl. He was sitting there doing force equations. Incomprehensible. The equations didn't balance and didn't make any sense. He was filling pages and pages with them. Still nothing to do with teleportation. Johnny almost skimmed by it. He backtracked. The picture showed Turl getting up, going over to the cabinet, and opening up another false bottom. He took out a huge sheet of paper, so big it would take 3 scanners' views to encompass it. The paper was very old, creased until it nearly fell apart, stained brown and faded. Turl spread it out, looked at it, and then shook his head over it. He traced one claw along the north side of the big dam, way to the southwest of the American mine site. He nodded. Then he wadded the paper up and threw it at the shredder bin. He wrote down some footage figures and some voltage figures, and then went back to his equations. And it was just equations for the next 2 days. And that was all there was in the disks. It took an hour of patching from 3 different scanner channels to get it, but Johnny recovered the huge piece of paper in its entirety and got a half dozen huge copies of it. It was entitled Defense Installations of Planet Number 203,534. Johnny knew already that was the cyclo name for Earth. It showed every mine site, every dam, every gun battery, and every something. A little symbol that trailed around each dam and below each power line from dams to mine sites and branch mine sites. Johnny had no idea what that symbol was. But there was a goodie he had never, never dreamed of. Marked clearly was a firing transshipment platform. He compared the cyclo mass of numbered locations with a man map of ancient times. The second platform was alongside a dam which had once been named Kariba in a country which had once been called Rhodesia and then Zimbabwe. The platform was marked Emergency Defense Armament Receipt Point. Obviously, if the main mine site were ever knocked out, Cyclo could send in another force, or the Cyclo command on the planet could demand troops, or at least inform the home office. Hopes soaring, but a little held down by the age of the map and Turl's treatment of it, Johnny had a marine attack plane on the line and Scots piling into it. Robert the Fox boarded hastily. Just as they were about to close the door, McKendrick piled in with a medical kit. Johnny sent the plane racing to the south. It was only about 1,000 miles away, and it only took them 35 minutes to spot the huge dam and lake and the mammoth installation. Some distance to the south and east of that, they saw what had been called Victoria Falls, one of the biggest waterfalls on the planet. Spectacular country. Because the area had been marked heavily defended, Johnny approached it cautiously. It was another branch mine they hadn't known the existence of. They found the compound some distance to the east and landed a platoon with assault rifles and radiation ammunition to make a cautious approach. A half hour later, they had the report on mine radio. The place was deserted and, the platoon officer reported, not much different from the one in the Aturi Forest to the north. The map had not shown the second platform at the mine site, but it was quite close to the huge dam. They took the platoon back aboard, and Johnny began to cruise the area. Trees, trees, trees. This was a high plateau, but not an open plain. Trees had been knocked down in swaths, where elephant herds had passed through. There were lots of little hills. Everything was masked with undergrowth except a few open places. Cruising along, elephant and African buffalo looking up at them, Johnny searched and searched. He had found before that it was one thing to look at a map, and quite another to be on the ground, and he was experiencing it again. Time after time he studied the map while Stormalong in the co-pilot seat kept them cruising above the treetops. Johnny finally got out some dividers and very carefully measured the distance from the dam edge, and then, taking the plane to that point and cruising it at the speed a horse walks, finally got them in the center of what must have been the point. Stormalong threw out a smoke flare to mark it, and a couple of big elephants took off. It was a bowl in the ground, the edges of which rose about 200 feet above the middle. It was like a crater, possibly even made with a bomb blast. It was about 1,000 feet in diameter. The bowl itself was so overgrown one could not see what was in it. But as the white smoke spired up, the truth hit Johnny. For centuries, perhaps, the company security officers of this planet had paid no attention to maintaining the elaborate planetary company defenses which once existed. No wonder Turl had thrown the map away. He looked so disappointed that Sir Robert tried to cheer him up. "We won't really know until we look closer." But it certainly was wilderness, receiving no care for centuries. Johnny put them down on the upper edge of the crater, and with riflemen ready to handle any hostile game, others got axes and began to hack their way down.
"Be careful around here," said Dr. McKendrick. "This area had an insect called the tsetse fly that brought on sleeping sickness. Also, the water had a worm in it that gets in the bloodstream. I don't have much in the way of medicines, but wear nets and stay out of the water."
"Great," said Johnny. That was all they needed. They cut their way down to the center of the bowl. They passed one of the transshipment poles 3 times before they spotted it. They paced out in various directions and located another 2. The 4th was easy. Johnny took a shovel and started down through the humus. He was hoping the company maxim of never salvage anything would hold true. 2 feet of dead leaves and humus down, he hit the platform. Axes ringing, they were getting trees and brush out of the way. They found the concrete base of the operations firing dome, and then finally the dome itself, upside down and some distance away. No console. Wires were eventually uncovered within the concrete base. Typically Cyclo, they were still well insulated when you scraped the mold off. Johnny was struck by the absence of the power lines. There should be power lines coming in from the dam. There was a power channel marked on the map and also that old squiggle he couldn't identify. Light was failing, and they would have kept on, but McKendrick made them get up to high ground. They spent the night listening to elephants trumpeting, lions roaring, and all the other cacophony of a very live jungle. But the night was quite cool, since this plateau had a fairly high altitude. In the morning, they dug a cross-cut trench and found the power line, being careful not to cut into it. They cut another trench and found the same line went on underground to the distant mine site. And there was another cable they couldn't identify that went along with the power line. Flogging their way through the brush, they went over to the huge dam. It was a real soaring monster of a dam. It seemed intact. The spillways were running. There were signs that cyclos had landed near it and gone in and out the access door to the powerhouse in some recent time. Johnny had never been inside one of these dams before. They vibrated with sheer, raw power. The thunder of the water and the high whine of generators made it impossible to be heard. It was the usual cyclo conversion, he supposed. It was very, very old, and some bits of the original man equipment that had been cast aside were very much older. Angus found the switchboard and bus bars, a vast, towering affair in a separate control room. Only two of the handles were clean, and it didn't need a little tuft of fur caught in one of them to tell that cyclos had come here to shut power on and off. But what were all these other bus bars? They got some mine sacks and tried to wipe the panel down without causing short circuits. There were cyclo letters inset into it. A whole row said, Force Stage 1, Force Stage 2, Force Stage 3. A second row said, Transshipment 1, Transshipment 2, Transshipment 3. Johnny gingerly rubbed some more with a mine sack, careful of closing any gap. They're color-coded. He tried to tell Angus this, but there was no talking in this place. They went back out. Turl, said Johnny to Angus and Sir Robert, is working on force equations. There is something on the north side of the American Dam I think he must want. The squiggles on this map must have to do with force. He sent Angus back into the power control house and placed some Scots along the underground line of squiggles and connected everyone up with mine radios. Close Force Stage 1, he radioed to Angus. The effect was far more drastic and dramatic than anything they expected. All inferno broke loose. Along the squiggle line of the map, all around the crater, trees erupted, splintered, soared, crashed. It was as if a bomb had exploded. Trunks and leaves and branches were falling for over a minute afterward. Sir Robert was running to find out what had happened to their spotters. Were they all killed? Their radios had gone silent. It took them an hour to dig the Scots out. One had been knocked unconscious. The rest were bruised and slightly cut. Six had been involved. McKendrick collected them and assessed the damages, and began applying the antiseptics and tape. Johnny made his way over to them from the dam. It looked like a first aid station after a battle. The one who had been knocked out had come to now. He had been blown in the air. Johnny apologized to them. The Scot that had been knocked out was grinning. "A little thing like that isn't likely to ruin a Scot," he said. "What was it?" "Yes, indeed. What was it?"
"Did I do something wrong?" Angus's voice came over the radio.
The Scots were all taking it as a joke, so Johnny said, "I think you did something right." They were out of the area now. "Close that switch again." A bit of the tree wreckage stirred and moved, and then was still. Johnny cautiously moved toward the bowl, and couldn't leave the dam area. He walked straight ahead, and then he couldn't go any further. He could not walk through the air before him. He threw a rock at it. The rock bounced. He tried again, throwing harder. Same result. He had Angus open the bus bar again. No barrier. Closed. Barrier. For the next 2 hours, by opening and closing the first and second row of bus bars and throwing rocks, they found that the dam itself was surrounded by a protective screen. The bowl had a screen all around its top and was completely enclosed. Riflemen even fired shots at it, and they glanced off. At stage two, the air got a bit shimmery, and Angus reported the power output meters were lower. At stage three, there was a strange electrical smell in the air, and the output meters of the total dam power dropped way down. Defense and more defense. A transshipment platform operating in that bowl could not be interfered with by attack. Not from the sides, and not from above. And neither could the dam. The amount of raw power it took to operate it was a large portion of the total output of this huge dam, and Johnny surmised that they changed stages of output to repel extreme attack and then eased them off to stage one when they needed power to transship. Johnny had them booby-trap the entrances in case their visitors upstairs came down for a look and prowl, and they took off in the early afternoon for home. A glimmer of hope. Not much, but a glimmer, Johnny told Sir Robert on the way home. He wanted Sir Robert, Johnny said, to take charge in the African area for the moment, for Johnny had some other things to look into elsewhere. He rebriefed the grizzled war chief on the existing situation. They were threatened by a possible counterattack from Cyclo. The visitors upstairs were waiting for something. He did not know what, but he was certain they would eventually strike. The political scene in America was a lesser menace, but existed, and they had to let it go on for now. The thing that would solve their troubles, Johnny said, was to get control of teleportation, or at least an operating console. With that, they could operate far more widely, but it seemed to be the most closely guarded secret the Cyclos had, and avenues to cracking it were not very hopeful. The main problem, Johnny said, was protecting what was left of the human race. They were no longer very numerous. A wide attack by the visitors or a counterattack by Cyclo could, either one, finish them as a race forever. Johnny, as soon as they landed, was going to leave for Russia to begin to handle this point. Would Sir Robert, Johnny concluded, take a few local protective measures, which Johnny then named? Robert the Fox said he was honored and certainly would. Such things were easily done. But did Johnny much care what happened to any visitors who might wander down? Johnny said no, and Sir Robert smiled. Chapter 22 1 The Bulbod punch craft was quite clear on the screen. Cylindrical, a small miniature of the Bulbod war vessel from which it came, it was about to make its landing near the dam. The small gray man sat in his small gray office and watched. He was mildly interested in a detached sort of way. He was very glad he had asked his communications officer to install the racks and extra screens. A Jambit Chow war vessel had joined them, commanded by an officer in glittering gold scales and eyes where his mouth ought to be. Had been informed of the situation, had been told that they didn't know yet whether this was the one, had agreed to join the combined force, and was now in orbit with the rest. The Jambit Chow face was now on its own viewscreen, watching, like the rest, the outcome of this punch, as the Bulbod called it. Six screens, five of them with intent faces, the sixth carrying the long-range view of this raid. For the last few days, the small gray man had felt much better. It had been a good idea to go down and see that old woman again. She was certain it could not have been her yarb tea that had caused his indigestion. Had he drunk anything in some heathen country? Well, never mind. Drink this buttermilk. He had drunk the buttermilk. It was quite cold and good to taste, and shortly his indigestion had greatly eased. But the old woman had not let it go at that. A cousin in some distant past had sent some plants to some ancestors of hers, and they were still flourishing up the hill near the spring. It was called peppermint, and she would go get some, and she had, steering a bit wide around the parked spaceship. The green leaves had a pleasant aroma, and he had chewed some, and, astonishingly, his indigestion eased even more. She had given him a whole pocketful of the leaves. The small gray man had tried to pay her, but she wouldn't have it. She said it was just the neighborly thing to do. He had persisted, however, and she finally said, well, there was a Swedish colony up the coast she was never able to talk to, and that thing around his neck, the one he talked into and it talked English, would it talk Swedish? He'd been happy to give it to her, he had several, and had changed its microplates while sitting pleasantly on a bench outside her door, with both the dog and the cow seemingly quite interested in what he was doing. It had been a pleasant afternoon. The bull-bod punchcraft banged down near the overgrown walkway at the dam. They were carrying a demolition kit.
I thought this was just a probe, said the Hoven. Didn't we agree they were just to discover what those people had done down at that dam?
They had watched the terrestrial antics around them, had seen them blow up a bunch of trees, and their curiosity had been greatly aroused. No heat had accompanied the eruption of trees, and nothing had burned.
If we use demolition on the dam, it could become political.
I command my own crew, rumbled the bullbot on his screen.
That was the trouble with combined forces. Everyone tried to run everybody else's ship. But combined force had been his idea, so he couldn't say much more. There had been three bullbot crewmen in the punch craft. The first one, carrying the demolition kit, was followed at some distance by the other two. The faces on the view screens were very intent as they followed this operation. It was their first probe down to the surface. The small gray man had tended to advise against it, but this was a military matter. They all knew that one must test the enemy's defenses. The leading bullbod was now about 50 feet from the powerhouse door. The roar of the spillway was coming back up the infrabeam very strong. That was an awfully big dam. Abruptly, there was a flash. A rolling ball of flame rocketed skyward. The image on the screen jittered from the concussion. The first bullbot had vanished, blown to bits. Whatever he tripped had also detonated his own demolition kit. The other two bullbots, who had been well behind him, had been knocked flat.
Aha, said the Hockner super-lieutenant, as though he had known it all the time. But the aha wasn't for the explosion. A marine attack plane that a moment before hadn't been on their screens landed clear of the explosion area. A small unit of people leaped out.
Swedes, thought the small gray man, seeing their blonde hair, led by a black-bearded young officer in kilts who carried a claymore and a blast pistol. A ramp went down on the attack plane's side, and a forklift rolled to the ground. The Swedes had some chains in their hands and were wrapping up the two recumbent bullbods. Thin little shouts of command were coming back up the infrabeam, almost engulfed by the roar of the dam spillway. The Scott officer was trying to find pieces of the exploded bullbod, picking up items of bloody cloth. He seemed to find something. He put it in a bag and waved to the forklift. They now put the huge bullbod bodies into the plane with the forklift. The lift came back and put the punch craft inside. The plane took off and went back north. The terrestrial group went into the powerhouse and vanished from sight. The faces on the view screens were hard to read. They were grappling with this situation. They didn't have too much time to ponder, for their second probe was now in progress, and infrabeams shifted to the snowy crest of Mount Elgon, which gleamed above the clouds far below. It had annoyed them to see an old device they took to be an ancient radio telescope mounted up there. It seemed to be tracking them as they orbited. A Hockner probe ship with 5 Hockners had been assigned to disable the device. And there was the Hockner probe now, nearing its destination. A Hockner probe carried no artillery itself, but the men did. The noseless, overly ornamented crew members were visible under the probe canopy. It was little more than a sled and was jet-powered. There seemed to be very high winds, and it was having trouble setting down on a broad, icy shoulder of the peak. There was a precipice there that dropped down into the clouds. Yes, it was a high wind. Plumes of snow were blowing away from the peak. Just ahead of them, but set well back from the edge, was the offending radio telescope. Beyond that object, out of the view of the probe craft, a glacier fell away. The faces watching it on their separate screens were quite different in reactions. It was taking the probe craft so long to get down to a landing, going out and back again time after time, that their attention was drifting. The Tallnep half-captain was doing some calculations about slave prices. He knew an air planet where you could get 1,000 credits a slave if you could get them there alive. He estimated that he had a potential here of about 15,000 landed live out of maybe 30,000 shipped. That was 15 million galactic credits. His 19% of that, the prize money he would get personally, would be 2,850,000 credits. His loaners were owed 52,860 credits in gambling debts, the reason he was happy to undertake a very long cruise, and this left him 2,797,140 credits. He could retire. The Hauven was thinking about all the silver and copper coins that must be in the ruins of old banks. The Cyclos valued neither metal, but he knew a market for it. The Bulbod had been thinking about all the Cyclo machinery down there up until the time his punch craft was captured. Now he was thinking about punching terrestrials. The Jambit Chow commander was wondering how he could do the rest of these aliens out of slaves, metal, and machinery. Finally, the probe craft made it and sat down on the ledge and their attention riveted on it. The 5 Hockners got out, bulky in their fancy spacesuits and clumsy in swinging their blast rifle straps off their shoulders. Suddenly, the voice of the Hockner landing control officer in orbit crackled out of their radios down there and came back up the infrabeam. "Alert to the battle plane!" There was a battle plane up at about 200,000 feet, but it had been there for an hour doing nothing, and it was doing nothing now. The 5 Hockners were looking at it, way up there, a tiny speck to them, hard to find in the blue sky they saw. "No, no!" barked the Hockner landing control officer. "Around the corner from you, coming up the glacier!" Only then did the watching faces see it. From their viewpoint, it was just a line on the glacier, just the top of its body showing, the rest cut off by the jutting crag above the telescope. The battle plane had hugged the glacier all the way up. It was almost 100 yards back of the telescope when it stopped. No one here could see whether anyone got out of it. It must be holding in that position on its motors. The glacier was steep. The 5 Hockners, alert now but seeing no one yet, crouched, guns ready. Then they sprinted forward. A hammering burst of blast guns flared just behind the telescope. One Hockner, near the edge, was hit, thrown out into space, and went spinning down through the clouds. The Hockner sled, struck by a burst, slithered backward, teetered, and dropped into empty space. The 4 remaining Hockners charged through the snow and wind, guns going. The relentless pounding of blast rifles racketed up the infrabeam. The whole area under the telescope seemed to be erupting continuous green gouts of thundering energy. 1 Hockner down, 2 down, 3 down. The 4th almost reached the telescope and then thudded into the snow. The only sound now was the whistle of wind around the peak. Several terrestrials sprang into view from beyond the radio telescope. They rushed forward, their red and white high-altitude suits looking like splashes of blood against the snow. They turned over the Hockners, took their weapons. One terrestrial looked over the edge where the 5th Hockner and the probe craft had fallen, but the only cushion down there was the tops of the clouds far below. The Hockners were picked up and lugged off by the terrestrials. Using safety lines and slipping and sliding down the glacier, they loaded the Hockners into the marine attack plane, which was now more visible. One terrestrial came back and checked over the radio telescope, and then he went sliding down the glacier, grabbed the door of the plane, and swung aboard. The plane took off and went down through the clouds. The infra beam shifted to penetrate the overcast and followed it back to the mine site.
That proves it, said the Tolnep half-captain. It was just as I thought all along.
He ignored the comments to the effect that he had favored the probes.
It was a lure, he continued. It is quite obvious that at the dam yesterday they went down and made a harmless eruption of trees to intrigue us. Then they lay in wait and succeeded in capturing two Bolbod crewmen. The radio telescope, he went on, is just a dummy as I suspected. They have not been used for centuries. Everyone uses infrabeams to pick up faint signals and broadcasts. So they put it there in an elaborate charade to attract down a probe. None of the Hochner crew, besides the one so clumsy as to fall off the cliff, were killed. The guns were all on stun. Thus they succeeded in luring four Hochners.
Should you be talking so plainly?
Said the Jambit Chow commander, stroking his polished scales.
They may have us on monitor.
Nonsense, said the Tolnep. Our detectors show no infrabeams, and we are just on local. I tell you no one has used radio telescopes since the Hambon Sun War. They have far too much clutter. They are too bulky. That's just a dummy down there. And did you notice the cute way that officer came back and adjusted it? They're just hoping we'll try again.
I shouldn't think they need to, said the Hoven. They now have two Bolbod crew and four Hochners to interrogate at leisure. Knowing Cyclo methods of interrogation, I shouldn't care to be those crewmen.
They're not Cyclos,
said the Hochner super-lieutenant, covering up the fact that he was aghast at the fate of his crewmen.
Yes, they are, said the Bolbod. You saw the Cyclo with the Terrestrials the other day down by the lake. The Cyclos are using aliens as a subject race. They've done it before. I vote we go down in an actual mass attack and pound out any installation they have now, before they are further prepared.
But at that moment they were startled when a hazy image appeared on all their screens. It was a gray, black-haired, and bearded human visage. The eyes were blue. The being seemed to be wearing an old cloak.
If you will turn up your transmission to planetary strength, this newcomer said in Cyclo, I would like to discuss returning your members to you. The two Bolbods are shaken up, but not hurt. The four Hochners are just stunned, though one has a broken arm.
They turned up to planetary strength, but their response was an emphatic, uniform no. The Tolnep half-captain managed to get his voice above the uproar.
So you can capture the rescue party? Emphatically, no.
We can put them all out on a slope, over by that black volcanic cone. All in the open, and no ships of ours in the air.
The Terrestrial was persuasive.
Call it a truce. Your pickup ship will not be fired upon or molested.
You haven't interrogated them that fast, said the Jambit Chow. So they must be dead.
They are quite all right, said the Terrestrial. Are you sure you won't pick them up?
Emphatically, no.
Very well, said the Terrestrial with a shrug of his shoulders. At least tell us what they eat.
The Tolnep gave a signal on his screen to the others. Let him speak.
Why, of course,
he said soothingly, smiling.
We will make up a food package and send it down.
They went off planetary.
I told you, said the Tolnep, that those incidents were a lure. Now two of you have bungled, so let me handle this.
Presently, a rocket-borne package went out of an airlock of the Tolnep ship. It was very well aimed, and its parachute burst open below the overcast. It went drifting down and landed just short of the lake shore. Presently, a vehicle went speeding away from the compound toward it. The faces on the view screens smiled. If those were Cyclos down there, or whoever they were in for a surprise. Then suddenly the Hochner super-lieutenant, who had been leafing hurriedly through a recognition book, said,
Oh, I say, that's a Basher Bashar way to glory tank.
totally armored.
The tank went down near the package, lowered a turret gun, and fired a mild stun shot into it. The package, being a bomb, of course, exploded in a geyser of flame. The tank fired a second shot at the remains. Then somebody got out of it and collected the hot fragments.
"We even gave them bomb fragments for analysis," shouted the Hoven.
They held a hasty conference. The small gray man listened to them. Military minds, he thought to himself, could be quite remarkable at times. They decided that anything those terrestrials did was just a lure, that the strategy of those people was to take the invader to bits piecemeal and then pulverize him, that they should now wait for the courier the small gray man said was coming sometime, the one that might tell them if the one had been found. Meanwhile, only the safest type of probe should be attempted in areas obviously not guarded or covered. Then, the moment they knew, one way or the other, whether this was the one, they would plunge in with a mass war vessel attack and defeat and gut the place. All the commanders agreed except the Tallnep. He was still in a rage about his bomb failing.
"I should go down there right now," hissed the Tallnep, "and bite the lot of them to death."
"We think that's an excellent idea," drawled the Hockner, adjusting his monocle.
"Yes, why don't you do that?" the rest agreed, and "we're sure you should." The Tallnep realized they would only be too happy to get rid of him. He subsided for now. Later would be another matter. Two. Johnny had gone on his trip to look at bases, but he found himself looking at people. The flight had been pleasant enough. A new pilot had thought he would be flying Johnny, but the very idea of having to be flown about amused him. He didn't have a broken arm. But an escort of 3 Mark 32 battle planes, long-range ones that also were designed to carry a squad of Cyclo Marines or employees, got into the air behind him when he took off and stayed right with him. He had flown northeast over Africa, the Red Sea, and the Middle East, and into Russia, making good time 200,000 feet up, and looking for a pattern of lakes and rivers Colonel Ivan had showed him with a finger in sand. He had expected to find snow, but although it was late autumn, the only snow was on towering peaks below and to the east. He found his landmarks, found his pre-planned landing space, and found himself in the middle of a sea of surging people. Colonel Ivan was holding them back with a dozen mounted lancers so that he had a place to land. There must be 500 people in that throng. He opened the door and was blasted with sound. They were cheering themselves hoarse. He couldn't even understand what they were saying. Such were the rolling waves of sound. He couldn't really distinguish individual faces among so many. Colonel Ivan dismounted as Johnny got down from the plane. The colonel was a little stiff and too formal, thinking possibly Johnny blamed him because of Biddy. The colonel was wearing a black band around his sleeve. But Johnny threw an arm around his shoulders, and it was abruptly all right. They had brought him a horse, a golden-colored stallion with a sheepskin saddle, and he swung up. The crowd cheered. He only knew one word of Russian, and that was «Здравствуйте», which meant «How do you do? Hello». So he called it loudly, and the crowd cheered. Johnny looked around. They were close to, in fact right up against the mountains, fairly high mountains, 14,000 feet. They had snow on them. The ancient Russian base must be nearby. He had thought they would go right to it, and he could get his observation and estimation done right away. But no, everybody seemed to have other ideas. There were some skin and felt tents, and fires put their smoke in the air, and suddenly Johnny realized this crowd was in their best clothes. This was a holiday, and the way they pressed in upon him, he certainly was the reason. He wondered fleetingly whether Thor had been up here, for if he had, then a lot of these people would think he knew them. Well, his one word of Russian would have to get him by. The colonel's horsemen were opening the way. Every time Johnny raised his hand and nodded, there was a new ear-bashing burst of cheering. Colors, faces. He knew the sound of Russian well enough to know it was Russian, but he was also hearing scattered words like Bravo! And Bueno! And Viva! Sounded like llaneros. Yes. There was a flat-crowned black leather hat, several of them, and some huge straw hats. The smell of roasting meat and the tang of dung fires was in the air. A band made up of balalaikas and Spanish guitars and Andean flutes and Mongol drums was splitting the air. The colonel got him to a skin tent that had been set up for him, and with a final wave of the hand and his one word of Russian, now no longer adequate, he got inside. A coordinator had also come in, and through him Johnny wanted to know, couldn't they go to the base now? The colonel was aghast. Yet, yet. There was time for all that. One had to think of the people. Many of them, in fact most of them, had never met Johnny before, had never even seen him. Johnny said he was thinking of the people, to get them safe from possible harm. Well, harm was always around, according to the colonel, but not every day was an opportunity to meet Johnny. Vyevna? Right? At that, Johnny was glad to get out of his heavy flight suit, for it was much less cold here than he had thought. The colonel had brought his kit in, but he ignored it. He had a near-white buckskin suit he had had made, not quite like the one on the credit banknote. Those loops there on each side of the breast were cartridge loops. But the village girls had done very well. Those moccasins should fit, but here were some military boots and red baggy pants if he preferred. This gold helmet? Well, it wasn't really gold. It was a lightweight Russian helmet, armor-proof aluminum, no less. And somebody flying through here had taken it down to the old mine site at Grozny and plated it with beryllium. See? It didn't have any star or ornament on it, but this chin strap with the heavy ear pads and the colored beads all over it had been done by one of the Siberian tribes. And wasn't it nice? And besides, Dr. McKendrick had told Johnny to be careful of his head after the fractures. So wear it. Johnny said he couldn't hear with it buckled. Wear it. Johnny washed his face and got dressed and told the colonel he was a bully, and the colonel confessed he was far worse than that. It was this way. His original plan to have Americans man this base had been passed by the old council before it went funny. They'd recruited some South Americans and sent them over. But there was a tribe up in the Arctic descended from political prisoners in Siberia, and they spent most of their time starving to death, so they had come down, en masse, dogs and all, and they were here. The Siberians were the ones out there in white bearskins. And then there was a little tribe they'd found in the Caucasus that had survived, and they were here. So it really was getting pretty manned up with Russians, but they had an American here. Yes, you want to see? He's right outside. The American was ushered in, and he was pulling a young girl behind him. He stood there, grinning. It was a boy from Johnny's own village, Tom Smiley Townsend. They were very glad to see each other. Tom Smiley was a big lad, almost as big as Johnny and a year younger. He said he had graduated from machine school and heard they didn't have enough operators over here for this job and had caught a ride. And he'd been working here for over a month, running minesweepers and teaching others and fixing things that broke down. This was his girl, Margarita.
Margarita, permíteme presentarte al gran señor Johnny.
The girl was very pretty, very shy, and overawed. Johnny bowed. He had seen Sir Robert do that. And she bowed. Tom Smiley said they were going to get married in a few weeks. And Johnny said he hoped they had lots of children. And Margarita blushed when Tom Smiley translated it, but nodded her head with enthusiasm. For the first time, Johnny learned the village had been moved. Tom Smiley had been trained so he could keep the passes open in winter using a blade scraper, and they wouldn't have the usual winter starvation. But now that they were moved, there was less snow. It was to the town Johnny had recommended, but Brown Limper had sent troops to force them to go to it. They had even had to leave their belongings behind. But he thought by now the other boys, two more were machine operators now and two were pilots, would have collected those up for them. The colonel pushed them out and gave Johnny a sip of the finest vodka ever brewed, and it almost took the top off Johnny's head. What a cure for flight fatigue. Must have been out of bear's teeth. The colonel said that was absolutely correct. How did he guess the formula? And took him outside again. This book is continued on Cassette 5, Side 1.